It's SAFM, it's Tuesday, it sure is. The Viewpoint with me, Songas Omabhekwe, this evening. But, I even forgot, you see, so we're going to get used to this, it's going to take some time. I've got a new name. It's Ngaba, N-Q-A-B-A. My new name is Ngaba. It's part of rebranding, but more than that, it's just me delving into deeper parts of who I am and tracing my identity and sort of fetching myself, if you like. So Ngaba is the name, N-Q-A-B-A. It's the same host that was Songas Omabhekwe, the same body, same mind, same everything, just using Ngaba instead of Songas. So I beg your pardon for that, and I suppose you will be forgiven for also referring to me as Songas, or if Songas or forgets that he is Ngaba. Anyway, the time is 2012. I'm going to have an interesting Hashtag Tuesday takeover this evening, precisely because the guest that the production team has been able to secure is one who doesn't follow the typical profile of our guests for the Hashtag Tuesday takeover segment, which is now 4.5 years old, so we're doing well for ourselves here. Pi Pacific Kabalira Uwase. Did I say that right, my brother?
Very much so.
Very much so. Okay. You've got a story to tell, but South Africans would relate in part with the year 1994. But before we start talking about things around the theme 1994, tell us about this song by Donny Donny, Africando. Tell us about the choice of this song, because it certainly isn't a song I've heard before, and many would perhaps draw inferences as to the nature and profile of the guest that we have by virtue of that song choice.
Yeah, thank you so much. Good evening, Songezo. I chose this song particularly because...
You forgot my name, right? But anyway, we move on.
Ngaba.
There we go.
Ngaba. Okay.
Yeah, fantastic.
Did I say it correctly?
You did. Ngaba,
okay,
yes.
I have to return the favor.
Thank you.
So the song I chose because... this is what is called African salsa, and the group is called Africando. I love dancing, and salsa is one of the types of music that I enjoy very much. And the song, what it says, is it is never too late. Africa will be fixed. Fixed America, they fixed Europe, and it is never too late. Petit à petit, that's French, it is little by little, we are going to get there.
Say that again?
Little by little.
No, the French part?
Petit à petit.
Petit à petit.
Yeah. In fact, Donny Donny, it's also to say... petit à petit, little by little, in Mali. I know that because in part of my work, I had a project in Mali, and people, part of that project, they had to pay little by little, mm-hmm. and they called it Donny Donny.
Donny Donny.
So,
and the project they saw through?
They saw it through. Little by little, they were building themselves up.
Kangane, we would say.
Kangane.
Let me ask this question. Uh-huh. In whose lifetime should we anticipate that Africa will be fixed? Because I don't want to bequeath an Africa that is not fixed to anybody. I want Africa to be fixed now for me to enjoy now. Now, I'm not even trying to engage the political aspects of it because it might sound as though I'm wearing a red beret. And perhaps that is their disposition, economic freedom in our lifetime. That's what they want. And broader than just economic freedom, I want the Africa that Africa can be, has the potential to be, is otherwise designed to be. I want to experience that Africa for myself.
Yeah.
Before my kids, so that when I've experienced this, I know exactly what it is that I'm leaving behind for my kids, hopefully making it a better version of Africa always. I mean, that's Kaizen, the Japanese saying of continuous improvement. But I want to live in a free, prosperous Africa where I can see you and Linda here in studio and not see a Zimbabwean woman or a Rwandan man, but just see a brother and sister from Africa.
Yeah.
And celebrate the diversity that we and all share and learn from your culture and your language and vice versa. And be able to explore my continent with the freedom that I'm otherwise designed to explore it. And know that I can invest in my government and that investment will return.
It's And that's a reasonable expectation to have for everybody, for every African citizen. One of the biggest challenges is that Africa as a continent, in my opinion, is a little too fragmented.
A little, you say.
Right. So it's so fragmented that, and we found ways to even deepen that fragmentation by imposing all kinds of restrictions, you know, to movement. And then you find, for example, in West Africa and other parts of Africa, you find some countries are in conflict, others are not in conflict. One of the regions that fascinate me is where Senegal is. Senegal is surrounded by countries that have some kind of conflict in one way or another.
Mm.
But it is stable. For me, they have their issues. They recently had some interesting developments, but eventually what at least one would call democracy triumphed, and they have now a new, very young president. But he's from the opposition, and it's not the first time that it happened. And it happened in a few countries. In Zambia it happened, in Ghana it happens.
There is a groundswell of young people taking over.
In Ghana it happens. In Kenya it happens. The opposition takes over. We don't know what's going to happen in South Africa.
29 May, yeah.
In 2 months' time.
We have a date of destiny, right. Don't we?
But the democracy where the opposition wins and wins fairly and takes over, it's not a strange phenomenon now in Africa.
Which is a good, not strange phenomenon.
It's very good. And so this, again, to come back to little by little, we will get there. So we all know.
Will you be prophesizing anything for what's to happen in 6 weeks in South Africa on the basis of little by little and opposition? Do you want to venture an opinion on that? And young leaders in opposition in particular?
Let me reflect. I had a conversation. I was in KwaZulu-Natal last week. I had a conversation with a member of the newest party, which is the MK, a very young person. And what he was telling me was, South Africa looks beautiful from outside. Other people experience South Africa as a developed country, and of course we know we have in South Africa advanced financial markets, all the things that somebody can say about South Africa being beautiful. But the average young person in South Africa, he was saying, is extremely frustrated and feels outside of this prosperous, beautiful South Africa. So, but that voice is now very loud. And so, can I say what is going to happen in 6 weeks?
I've been asking you, yes.
I don't know. I hope
is
that it will all be peaceful.
Yeah, we'll certainly all hope for that. You know, that point that you've made, I think it's largely correct, or certainly well-founded. I was over the weekend in the Western Cape. Man, but Cape Town, Stellenbosch, that line, the best and worst of South Africa is there. Yeah. Juxtaposing each other. Main Road, Rondebosch, there by the university precinct, there's an old cemetery, and I understand it's a Muslim cemetery from when they were still residents before District 6 happened. Right there, I mean, I would think a graveyard would, across races, across nations, across everything, demographically, it would be a sacred space. There's an informal settlement right there.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yeah. But South Africa
is... And you're looking at this majestic mountain that is a billion rand industry.
Yeah.
The properties around there, the tourism around that, and the fact that it is so symbolic of Cape Town, the tourist hub for South Africa. What's happening right now following the weather disasters in Kayamandi? Kayamandi is in Stellenbosch. If I say Stellenbosch, the next word I probably would say is billions. I'm not even going to go this nefarious term, mafia, whether or not it has resonance or place, I don't know. But Stellenbosch billions, and then you have Kayamandi. And the struggle that I just cannot.
yeah,
reconcile with a lot of this freedom and equality that South Africa boasts.
And you are not the only one. And young people now that we have social media, which is fairly accessible now for mm-hmm. the rich and the poor, we have ways to have many people express themselves, and the voice that is coming through is this frustration of seeing beauty right in front of you, but you can't touch it.
It's inaccessible, yeah.
And South Africa is one of those, I think, in my opinion, is actually the only country I can say this about. The worst of the worst you can find in South Africa.
Absolutely.
Poverty, crime, and absolute corruption, all the whatever you can say that is bad,
all
you can
find.
All
the antisocial things.
But actually, it's the country where you can find the best of the best.
That is also
one
true.
Of the best banking systems. The healthcare, the private healthcare is amazing. The universities are actually
world class. Very much so.
You find people who find this Omicron. Yeah, the researchers who this virus. So. What I experience about South Africa is that the worst of the worst is colliding with the best of the best every single day. And I think this is one of the reasons why there is no dull moment in South Africa. This, you have investigative journalists. You have people who are going to uncover all of these things. You have courts. Now courts have you kind of need to have some notion of, you know, law to listen to news in South Africa, because it's just colliding every single day, but it makes it exciting as well.
What's also exciting, to use that term, is a book that I'm holding. It reads, Witnessing from the Rwandan Tragedy to Healing in South Africa, Pipe Sefik Kabalira Uwase, and that is you. Tell me about this book. As a 14-year-old boy in Rwanda, Pipe Sefik Kabalira Uwase survived war atrocities, but he had to leave home if he wanted to stay safe. In his book, Witnessing, he recounts his colorful childhood in Kigali and his harrowing experiences of the genocide. For his safety and future, he prepares to flee Canada, but ends up in South Africa after being scammed and losing all his money. He works as a car guard in the Durban city center, studying between shifts and dreaming of university. Despite obstacles, he enrolls at university and is awarded the Mandela Rhodes Scholarship. In this emotional but rewarding journey of self-discovery, we witness Pipe Sefik confront the depth of the traumatic past and reach for his dreams. He's now the founder and director of the PEM Afurika, P-E-M Afurika. Tell me more about you. Tell me more about this book. That's my final question to you. You've got until 5:30 at most.
Yeah, thank you so much. Well, again, actually, before I start about talking about it, I would say the fact that I was able to have time to write this book is a huge privilege that I would not have had it not been to thanks to the way South Africa is. I lived in Rwanda. I was 14 when the genocide took place. Actually, just before I turned 14, I was 13 in 1994. I turned 14 in August. I was old enough to understand and see and witness what was happening. And the particular circumstances of my family were such that my mother could not move around because we were on the lists of people who had to be killed. And I was the eldest. But one of the things that people might not connect to is that in war, people still need to live. So you need water, you need vegetables, you need charcoal to cook. So I was old enough to be the one doing those errands. Unfortunately, on
you
my way there, that's where I witnessed the fullness of the Rwandan genocide as it happened. So I saw, unfortunately, I got to witness things a child should not see. Because you see, people I knew killing people, I knew. And it took me a long time to make sense of that. And so the book is an attempt for me to say, come and witness with me as a young boy growing up in this context where this happens? How does a young boy live through this? And so you witness and you grow with this boy, and then eventually goes into exile. I didn't know where I was going. I actually wanted to go to Canada. I was scammed in Tanzania, where my money was taken away from me.
All of it?
Almost all of it. I was left with about $300. They took about $2,100, pretending to put together some way of, you know, of taking me to Canada. The very family that received me was the one orchestrating that. And then I decided, because one of the things that my family instilled in me is education, education, education. So I decided my life is not possible in a non-French, in a non-Francophone country. So that's when I decided to go to Madagascar. And I thought, I was 20 at the time, I thought, if I go to Mozambique, it will be easy for me to go to Madagascar. I mean, how hard can that be? Because it's so close. But actually, it was, you know, as I discovered later, impossible. I ended up in Maputo, and that's where a series of
Are you moving on your own? How are you getting by? Are you documented in all of this? Where's your family?
So my family had been told while I was in Tanzania that I have already arrived in Canada. So all this time, my family thinks I am in Canada. I am on my own. I have a little bit of money left on me, and I just want to get to a Francophone country so that I can declare myself as a refugee and then fight my way to university. That was the plan when I left Tanzania.
But when you left Kigali, yeah, you were 14. Would you have schooling?
I lived in Rwanda for about 6 years after the genocide.
Okay, I see.
Yeah. I did high school.
You did complete your high school.
Yeah, I did high school in Rwanda.
How did you survive that? Because there had been a number on your back. I mean, you were supposed to have been killed, to use your words.
Well, during the genocide, and then, of course, as the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, took over the country, and the genocide ended, we returned back to Kigali.
Were the tensions eased?
It was very bad. We found that our house had been completely looted, so we had to start life from scratch. And just to give you a picture of what that was like.
Yeah.
When we returned home after the genocide, we found a sign on the door that said, "This house is occupied." What that means was that as the RPF took over the power, there were many refugees who were in Burundi and Uganda. They came behind them, but they had no property, no houses. But they were coming into a country where if people who were there were not dead, they were in exile. So there was this exodus.
Assumption,
So they just occupied whatever house they found. So they rightly took the house. So we arrived the day before the family that took it occupied it. So then we had to settle, clean up. And then the following day they came. I remember the conversation my mother had with this man who spoke Kirundi. It's very close to Kenya-Rwanda. He was coming from Burundi. He could not wrap his mind around the fact that my mother is saying, "This is my house." What he thought was, "I'm also coming to take this house." He said, "No, but I came before you. I was here before you." My mother says, "No, I don't mean that. I mean, this is my house from before." So he says, "You were here before?" Like he could not understand.
So how was that settled?
His meeting. No, he eventually, my mother offered him an annex. We had a little annex with his family. And then he went to look for another house. And fortunately, he found another house the very same day. That also tells you how few people were in Kigali just after the genocide. So just to give you a picture of what that was like. So then I lived in Rwanda. I went to high school at a very prestigious school, actually called La Colombière. And there, I went there against the wish of my family. My family didn't want me to go to that school because they thought it was dangerous for me. Because I was, to give you an idea, in my class, I was the only one who grew up in Rwanda who was there. Mm-hmm. All the other children who were in, other learners were returning from exile. They were born in exile. And so they, most of them didn't speak Kinyarwanda, so they had to learn Kinyarwanda from scratch. And I was forced to speak French. I'm so grateful for that now, because that French that I learned during my high school years is now serving me as I work through the continent, because I can now work in Francophone countries. So at the time when I left my country, I was 20. I had just been to the University of Rwanda, but just 2 years earlier, in 1998, my brother had been killed, and my family would not stop asking me to leave. They said, just go, because your brother was killed. We asked you to leave. You didn't go. Now we are afraid of losing you too. So that's how a 20-year-old got to leave the country, with a little bit of money my uncle gave me. Then the money gets stolen in Tanzania. Then I have to force my way through trying to go to Madagascar and end up in Durban and surviving as a car guard.
And you became a Mandela Rhodes Scholar.
And that's the story in the book, is how I had highs and lows dealing with, obviously, the trauma, but also I had, you know, other amazing moments, like, of course, being awarded the Mandela Rhodes Scholarship.
The indefatigable, how's that for a word? The indefatigable spirit of a human being. And when that human being is good, you cannot keep that man down. You cannot keep a good man down. And the indefatigable spirit.
SAFM, leading the conversation. Tuesday Takeover on The Viewpoint. Songe Somapete on SAFM.
Good evening. I'm P. Pacific Kabalira Uwase, your Tuesday Takeover guest for this evening. And my guest this evening is Daniel Oparison. Daniel is a friend that I met while I was working in Nigeria. In fact, he was working at one of our clients as the head of operations, and that's where we met. I would like to say a little more about Daniel. He is a seasoned and results-oriented brand and business growth strategist with 15 years of executive experience in strategic leadership, operations and organizational culture, brand innovation, customer acquisition and retention across financial and professional services, along with fast-moving consumer goods industries. He has a proven track record of crafting and executing scalable strategies for market entry, business transformation, and growth. He strives as an enabler with the ultimate purpose of enabling people, business, and nations reach their potential. So, Daniel, there is one more thing I would like to say about you. Is that you?
Okay.
You actually stood on the summit of Kilimanjaro, the tip of the whole continent.
Yes, I did. I was blessed, fortunate to have the opportunity to do that. Seemed crazy when I first thought about it, but yeah, I did it. I did it. Thanks to God, I was able to.
It's a great achievement.
It's great to speak with you.
Likewise.
Thank you so much.
So our conversation will be centered around the images and reputations of our countries outside of our borders. Please, listeners, join the conversation
on 086-000-2023 or send us a voice note on 0614-104-107. Right, Daniel, I'm going to start with a question while we're talking about the reputation of countries. What okay. is the image of South Africa in Nigeria?
Okay. So I don't claim to speak for every Nigerian. There will be Nigerians listening to this and already tapping their laps thinking, what's he going to say? But from my personal experience and from the experience of people close to me, it is largely positive. There are a few things that, you know, come to mind as soon as you think of a South African, or you meet a South African and you're thinking, can you do the dances? Can you teach me how to dance? You know, the jokes that come off that, you mm-hmm. know, there's people who talk about the fact that, hey guys, come on, let's make it easy for us to get the visas to get into SA. Come on, you know, because there were the diplomatic and somewhat political issues that limited that.
Yeah.
But then people think about how beautiful it is. People talk about how beautiful it is. You meet the South African, and whatever part of South Africa they're from, and you, in my experience, hear the joy that they have and how proud they are of being South African. Mm-hmm. And of being known as South African, mm-hmm. and everything that stands for, mm-hmm. right? The culture, the music, and really one of the, particularly around the younger generation, that have been looked up to, right, across
yeah.
Africa,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
right? And also around education, right? It's it's one of the critical areas that South Africa has really shined a light on the continent. Right. So it's largely positive and inspiring, mm-hmm. right, as a place. My father lived there for many years, and his stories were largely positive. There were certain unfortunate incidents, right, mm-hmm. but largely positive.
And that's great news, because it actually turns out to be my experience as well, that the image of South Africa outside of South Africa is largely positive. And then there are these mm-hmm. there are these blips where there is, for example, in the news, a lot of reporting about the xenophobic attacks, for example. And then for a period of time, you can sense. I remember I had this experience. I was going to Cote d'Ivoire, and as I gave my travel document, I have a travel document from South Africa. It's not a passport. It's a travel mm-hmm. document for people in South Africa who cannot otherwise have a travel document. And it says South Africa. And when I gave her that document, she said, without looking at me, she said, "You black South Africans should stay in your country and not travel, not go anywhere." That's the word. She said it in French. And and then I thought, for a moment, I thought, no, she said it in English. It was, you know, in the very heavy French accent. But then I engaged her in French, and I said, "Tell me more about that." And I could see, and you and I will know where that came from.
Yes,
it's part exactly. of the work that I was doing in Nigeria. Because when you have these yes. moments of where you don't know what to do and you get something you don't expect, you can choose to engage immediately or you can take a step back. And one of the ways mm-hmm. I do that is to say, "That's interesting. Tell me more about that." And she was surprised by that reaction. And then she put up her stamp down. And then she said, "Okay, let me tell you. When I was a young girl, I remember in school running in the streets of Abidjan, chanting, 'Libere Mandela, Libere Mandela.' And that means, you know, free Mandela. And then, but now, fast forward now, our brothers and sisters are in South Africa and you are giving them a hard time. And then we both instantly realized, I'm on a queue, I need to move along. And then with a big smile, she said, "Welcome to Côte d'Ivoire." And she gave me the stamp. And then I went through. But the reason why I'm telling this story is this is a senior immigration officer you could see because of the stars and the cords around her, who has that perception, who attacks me because she thinks I'm black South African. And you can imagine then, this is not just an average person, but you can imagine what the sentiment is to people who consume that kind of news.
Very, very true. I mean, first, I applaud you for, but I'm not surprised knowing you, P, for the way you handled and responded. I think a lot of us can learn from that because there's a lot of ignorance. There's a lot of pain. You know, they say hurting people hurt. So people who have either had damaging experiences and haven't dealt with them will go on to try and inflict those on other people, sometimes unwittingly. You know, I know of conversations that I have heard where within Nigeria, people will speak sometimes seemingly factually about white South Africans and, you know, the part that they're playing negatively in, as it was said in a conversation, in extending or giving their own colonial, making their own colonial behavior in within Nigeria, because they come and they have these certain airs and certain vices, and they have sometimes diplomatic immunity and all. Now, that might be true and it might happen every now and then, but unfortunately, the way it affects people negatively causes them to have that sentiment, you know, and there's work to be done for us as individuals to first, I believe, see less of the broad blanket descriptions and begin to try and connect with the person, which is what you did at that point, right? You caused a bit of a connection with that lady.
Absolutely.
And hopefully she begins to think differently, you know? But there is work to be done.
There is
broadly on that.
And one country that is doing work around their image, I'm very proud to say, is Rwanda. I mean, from 1994, we are 30 years now later. And everywhere I travel, when I say I'm Rwandan, I immediately get a lot of good things about the leadership, about Rwanda being clean. And it's evident also, you know, Rwanda, that they are putting a lot of resources in marketing the country. You know all about Visit Rwanda if you are a national fan.
Correct.
There is the NBA Africa happens in Rwanda next year. The UCI, those who are cyclists, the first world championship will be in Rwanda. I believe the organization that gives, you know, Formula One trophies and the prize giving ceremony will take part in Rwanda later this year. So there is a lot that Rwanda is doing to evidently manage the image of the country.
Yes, it's phenomenal. You know, my experience spanning brand strategy for political campaigns, for organizations, and some state branding makes me say that beyond the image that they are portraying, they're doing the work to back it up. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're, it's not always 100%. There will always be things that people can say should be done better, but they're doing the work to back it up. I remember my first trip and, you know, literally stepping out of the airport. In fact, within the airport, I wasn't allowed to take a nylon bag, which had, I don't know, maybe a chocolate bar or something.
Yeah.
You know, when you are able to orient a people
and help them think aligned and help them understand the part that they play in the overall mission, right? That's a big part of doing the work, and it's working. And obviously, so it makes it easy to then publicize the image. It makes it easy for people to then want to participate in that. You know, they're also doing a lot around agriculture. I know a few people that are launching there. You know, there's some strategy work I was doing with a client, and he was talking about setting up shop. He's Nigerian. He had gone through the process, unfortunately, difficultly within Nigeria, but he had launched it in a shorter period
in Rwanda.
So it's fantastic. It's fantastic. They're backing up the image with substance, you know.
Fantastic.
It's great.
Again, good evening. My name is P. Pacific Kabalira Owase. I'm your Tuesday Takeover guest for this evening. My guest is Daniel Oparison. So please join the conversation on 086-000-2032 or send us a voice note on 0614-104-107. Please keep your radio off when you're recording your voice note and keep your voice note under 1 minute. We have two voice notes. Let's hear.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen. Great topic indeed. To both of you, I just want to check, not because you guys are representing the views and the aspirations of other people who happen to be in the diaspora, Africans in particular who are in the diaspora, whether in the Europe area, in the Americas, everywhere else, in their minds, in their dreams and aspirations, what do you think they wish for their respective countries, wherever they are? They might have left their respective countries because the civil wars, there's whatever reason that makes them to leave their countries. What dreams do they have for their respective countries? This is Kaba from the Eastern Cape. Thank you.
Good evening, gentlemen there. Very decent topic that you guys are having there. You know, the story of you in Ivory Coast really make me afraid to visit African countries anymore. I've never been out of South Africa, but it just instills some fear about what other Africans think about South Africans. Thank you very much. This is Marvin in Bloemfontein.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Let me start with this. I can tell you, I travel a lot across the continent. I've been so far to 25 countries in my work. You do not have to fear traveling because you are South African, because you are black. As much as there is this incident and a couple of others, there are also incidents where people are genuinely curious about what is happening in South Africa. In fact, I even get questions from people asking me, tell us about the experience of black people in South Africa after apartheid. Like, they are curious to know how black South Africans are evolving within the context of South Africa. And so I also had an experience of a radio producer in Liberia who was telling me that he's refusing to report on xenophobia and because he doesn't want the image of South Africa to be damaged, and he was resisting the pressure from his bosses to report on that. So I would like to say I don't think there is cause for concern as far as traveling on the continent is concerned. Daniel, there's something that I wanted to ask you. What do you think is the role of us as individuals we can play in managing the reputations of our own countries? Now, of course, when we talk about the reputation of a country, it's a big topic, it's a big concept. But as individuals, what is it that we would do to contribute to building the image of a country?
Thank you, P. I think it's a great question, and it ties into my thoughts on the first gentleman's question. I would say, I mean, exploring this is particularly within the context of South Africa, as initially we spoke, and also Nigeria, my home country, it really presents a rich tapestry as you think about it. There's a social, economic, and cultural narratives that we can pull out as to how the individuals can influence the view of their country. Mm. I think two things for me that stand out are integrity and the citizenship or citizenry.
Mm. Because we sometimes don't appreciate how our actions actually can be seen from as far away as outside the borders of our countries, especially because,
exactly,
you know, social media now, when you put something on TikTok, it is instantly global. It's not,
yep,
it's not just in your country. When you,
yep,
so our actions and our thoughts and our mindset and our feelings, they travel far and wide nowadays.
Yes, they travel extremely far and wide, and they make significant impacts,
yeah,
probably beyond what we would expect or assume,
yeah,
right? I mean, if in terms of the, if we look at the positive aspects first, mm-hmm, there's multiple things that, and using some examples, there's multiple things that we're seeing where, take Nigeria that is now known for its fintech leadership, right? Mm-hmm. Probably immediately after Kenya, that really kicked that off, mm-hmm, with M-Pesa. Mm-hmm. Take SA with its cultural exportation, right? Everything from music to dance to education. Now, all these things, globally renowned and impactful, were really kicked off by individuals, mm-hmm, right, that believed. I think a real sense of belief in the purpose as an individual, and the fact that you, and understanding that you can make a contribution. Mm-hmm. A weakness of mine, my wife will be the first to say, is I think I can solve everything. Mm-hmm. But I think over the years, I've hopefully become wiser to understand that at the very least, I can contribute to that.
Yeah.
And as people see that as an opportunity to contribute to a change, to a transformation,
yeah,
while respecting the fact that it will take time, I believe they then take on that purpose, right? And I class it as integrity and citizenry, right?
Yeah.
Integrity, are you, what are we actually standing for as individuals?
Yeah.
What are we declaring it with our actions and our behavior, especially the things that are not necessarily professional,
yeah,
right? Because we tend to act right when it's professional, you know.
Yeah.
The joke is, in London, a Nigerian will queue up, but as soon as he gets back to Lagos, right, he wants to jump the queue. But we're finding now that he wants to jump the queue. He believes I'm the one, put me in front. But that's also not every Nigerian, you know, but that, those are sort of the blanket statements and thoughts that people, yeah, tend to have.
Yeah,
but I know Nigerians, I know South Africans, I know Africans, particularly from university days, yeah, and even still within the work that I do,
yeah,
that have a profound sense of integrity and, yeah, that citizenry, that belief in what they're about and how they are a representation of their nations.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I think a key point, just finding to the question that the gentleman asked, I'm finding that unlike, yeah, say 10 years ago, a decade ago, where we were, you know, people were moving back home from wherever countries they were in diaspora, wanting to go and make home better. You know, that's changing now. There's a lot of migration out of the African countries, but at the same time, it's people moving back. So that globalization effect means, yeah, that you are anywhere you are now, but you are thinking as a representation or representative of your nation.
Of your nation.
You know, and it's therefore significant.
And therefore of your continent. Yeah.
Correct, and therefore of your continent. Yeah.
We have a call coming through. Bramoro in Bloom.
Yes please. Yes. Bramoro is originally from Ghana, West Africa.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I wish we can have you most often on the show, especially to explore about the problems confronting other African states. I always say South Africa is the little baby we have in Africa. But there is a lot of things that we can learn from this country to go back home and develop our various countries. Mm-hmm. Ghana is the first country to gain freedom in sub-Saharan Africa. Aside Ethiopia, that was never colonized. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the current political situation in Ghana, it's honestly a distasteful moment that we are witnessing, to the extent that even Ghanaians in the diaspora are unable to even get proper service from their various embassies. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure Nigerians are not even exempt from this crisis, if we are to even divert into that angle. So the advice that I can give to all of us listening to SAFM this particular time is, let us take critical lessons from the current situation in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Regardless of the problems confronting this country, they unite as one, regardless of ANC or DA in between them. They unite, even if they have to demonstrate peacefully, to demand for service equality for all. They do that. Whereas in our various countries, politically, we are divided. Mm. Let's look at the historic moment happening in Senegal. A young boy under 50 years, who is now serving as a president, who is serving as a president and his prime minister. Mm. Can we have such in Cameroon? Can we have such in Ghana? Can we even have such in Nigeria? Let me leave it here for the sake of time.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, thank you, Bramoro. And as the song said, petit à petit. L'oiseau fait son nid. What that means is, little by little, a bird builds its nest. So we are making steps, and South Africa certainly has a lot of lessons to teach the rest of the continent. Do we have a voice note?
Hello, gentlemen. Senator from KZN. I would like to hear from either both of you gentlemen or anybody that wishes to address this, that in South Africa we are currently faced with a situation of a huge number of illegal, an influx of illegal foreign nationals. The first question would be, what's your guys' take on that? How do you feel about it? Like, if you want to say anything. And then the second one is, what do you think has led us to this situation where this is happening, as well as how, if any suggestions, how do we resolve it? Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Are we going to news?
On the viewpoint.
Good evening again. I'm P. Pacific Kabalira Owase. Tuesday takeover continues. There was just before the news with Modupi, there was a voice note from KZN about illegal immigration in South Africa. And one of the things that is in the news a lot as well, and it's certainly an issue that needs to be confronted. Now, the one thing I would like to say about it is that it is not a phenomenon that is unique to South Africa. This is something that you are going to find a lot of countries that have opportunities, or at least are perceived to have a lot of opportunities, will attract migrants, and you know about many Africans drowning in the Mediterranean trying to cross into Europe, and even within Africa, the illegal migration is not only in South Africa. Morocco and Tunisia are facing the same issue, and in especially people who consume media from the Francophone side of Africa would know that there is a lot of perceived xenophobia from these countries, and they are trying to resolve it as best as they can. However, I think it's an issue that needs to be dealt with. Now, there are two sides to this. One is in South Africa. I think there is a lot to be done in terms of administration and in terms of managing borders, as many people say. But I think the long-term solution to this is more about countries where the migrants come from. So long as you have conflict, you have economic depravity, you have poverty that is glaring in many countries where educated people seem to hit a roadblock as soon as they graduate and they have absolutely nothing, they are going to do whatever they can to get to places where they think are greener pastures. And often they actually go there despite, and I want to emphasize this, despite the great risks that they are aware of, including sometimes risks to their own lives, just because they want to get out of there and get to greener pastures. So there is a, it is a problem that needs to be acknowledged. It's a problem that needs to be managed. And I think South Africa is doing its bit in, I know that there are new legal frameworks and legislation, and Home Affairs is trying to manage it as best as they can, but it cannot be ignored. Right, there is a message that is amazing. That is an amazing discussion, gentlemen, from Cecile Stimela in East London, Scenery Park. Scenery Park. Oh, Daniel, your final thoughts.
Well, thank you, P. I think on this on the question that the gentleman asked just before we went on the news, it's an extremely complex situation, and there's a lot that needs to be done. I mean, even within Nigeria, with all the positive steps that the government is taking, the local governments and the federal government, it is even difficult because we have people coming in from across the border, right? But as you say, they're looking for, quote unquote, the greener pastures, right? Even though we in Nigeria will say there's a lot of work that we need to do for the greener pastures for ourselves, there are people coming in. I think ultimately, and this answers the initial question that you asked, I think we really need to look at the massive transformative purpose that we need to strive for, right? As individuals, being representations of our nations, and also as nations, right? We have significant positive steps that African countries are doing when they seek that purpose. It's a shared purpose. Kenya and Uganda, there's a lot of infrastructure development, trade and energy collaboration. Rwanda and Ghana, that the other gentleman was talking about, a lot of digital innovation and governance partnerships. You know, Egypt and Sudan, right? I mean, even though there's the difficulty that Sudan is facing now, they've had these positive collaborations when, in my view, the leaders of the nation and the individuals that are fortunate to be able to represent those nations in diaspora, when they have a clear understanding of that transformative purpose that they're seeking, right, that is beyond them. Hopefully, as you look beyond yourself, as they look beyond themselves, they're seeking better for them, for the nation. And hopefully that brings a different level of collaboration, right? Mm. And we've seen that positively, even with the Africa Free Trade Agreement, right, and AfCFTA. There's work there. It's slow, just like the parable you read about the bird's nest. Mm. It's slow. Sometimes it's painful, but it's moving. And I think we need to have that mindset and then contribute to it, not just speak about it from a distance.
Have the mindset and contribute to it. Thank you so much, yes. Daniel. Thank you for joining me on this Tuesday takeover. It has been a great pleasure to have you on the line.
Thank you, P Pacific. Always a great pleasure to speak with you.
Likewise.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful. We have Songezo Ngcaba back.
I am indeed back, and thank you so much for a thoroughly engaging conversation, and just your very calm demeanor is very different to how I do things, but looking at the contributions from the listeners, it clearly is something that landed with them, so maybe I might just draw a leaf from or a page from your book in terms of just hold a calm demeanor and almost be like that quintessential gentleman who it would sound like nothing can ever get under your skin. P, thank you so much for honoring the platform and engaging as well as you have and really unearthing some new voices. I mean, there's a gentleman from Scenery Park there. I mean, I don't recall Cecil Stumela participating on the show unless I'm wrong. Bao Stumela, you must come in. Dan Konza Galugu. SN Peters, the Scenery Park, and said in Dotan and Goko. So you must call me and participate in my programs, please, not just because I'm bringing guests to the show. P, how are you feeling? How was that experience for you?
It was amazing. I was nervous at the beginning and I'm amazed by the response, by the way. I want to thank the listeners. I can see that there's more voice notes and it's actually incredible. But I have to say, I will never take for granted the work that you do sitting in this chair. I have 1, 2, 3, 4 screens that I'm looking at, and they have a couple of people in my ears, and then I have to remember the time, and then I have to, and then of course engage with the listeners.
There are many moving parts.
And all the time. So
It comes with time. I mean, I think my first show here on SAFM was on 1 April. Yeah. Monday, 1 April 2019. People thought it was a joke. It wasn't. It wasn't April Fool's at all. I was live on air. And that was as nervous as I got. And it took me another 2 or 3 shows to get sort of those jitters out of the way. Mm. I'd done it for 18 months before. It helped. But I mean, it's still a new platform, new audience, new everything. Yeah. And you got to respect the platform. And I think I take that comment as what it is. You just came to respect the platform and the people honored you with it. Nice. So thank you very much. We are indebted and thankful.
No, such a pleasure.